I'm Richard Lannan, writer at Canon, and this is the Glazing Insider Industry Podcast. Welcome to the podcast dedicated to the people of the glazing industry. In this episode, I talk with Lauren Jenner, who is the managing director of the Coastal Group. In this conversation, Lauren talks us through how he started in the fenestration world and the journey of the company. So, without further ado, let's get started. Lauren, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming on. You are the managing director of the Coastal Group, but how did you get there? How did you join the fenestration world?
Yeah, so the journey started roughly 2003. So my father and myself were in the office refurbishment industry.
Right.
The dad was a bit fed up with filling other people's pockets because he was a project manager there. So eventually we came down to Cornwall fairly often, and the opportunity came where we would refurbish our friend's unit. And as a result, we then moved into his old, what we call a corn store, which has been recently raided as a marijuana store.
Oh, so they were making some real money there.
We kept to metal work, yeah. 2004, we moved down from London to Cornwall,
right,
set up a little business. I joined Dad 12 months later. Remember him getting his first order for 4 Samuel Heath slide bolts in antique brass.
Right.
Bit of a sad point there. But yeah, that was a good one. When we first started, we were just typical architectural ironmongers. So we were selling, you know, typical internal doorstep stuff like door closers, kick plates, locks, handles, all that kind of thing. But for some reason, I had quite a passion for external joinery. So anyone making external timber doors and windows. So I kind of sort of fixed on that and kept that my focus day to day. And over the years, that became a dominant part of our business. And we actually ended up selling the architectural ironmongery business to another company. Because also during that time, we took on a business selling stainless steel balustrading systems. So at one point in our business, we had architectural ironmongery, jewellery hardware, and stainless steel balustrading items.
Right.
And we got to the stage where we couldn't physically have a sales meeting because we had like all these different teams, different product groups, different target markets. It was a nightmare. We couldn't even have a sensible sales meeting. So we thought it's ridiculous. And we took faith in the word focus.
Yeah,
makes sense. So we sold off the stainless steel balustrading business to a local company. And we also sold off the architectural ironmongery section of our business. This would have been 2008, roughly. And so overnight, we literally chopped our revenue, our turnover in half by selling off these two kind of sub outlets. But it's the best thing we ever did because within 12 months, we were back up to where we were 12 months previous. And that is all down to the key word of focus. You can't be good at everything.
That's smart.
Too many people out there think they can be good at everything. And you're just diluting efforts. So yeah, purely believed in being a master at what we do. Anyway, so back into the jewellery hardware section. We sell quite a popular Scandinavian window system, which operates in a particular groove around the frame, particular groove around the sash, and all of the hardware, you know, friction hinges, butt hinges, keeps, everything clips into the same groove. We sold that quite successfully. But what people were moaning about was the butt hinge. So this butt hinge was just a basic 70mm steel, then zinc-plated butt hinge, and it would corrode like within months.
Wow.
And that's when we first learned about the power of saline air, you know, the power of salt water, incredibly powerful, and it's something that people underestimate massively today. So anyway, we managed to get a design together for this 70mm 316 stainless steel butt hinge, and that was the first product that we brought out in what is now known as Blue. That's our brand. So we started selling that quite successfully. And then as a result of that, customers were saying, wow, we really like this marine grade metal. And it was obvious at the time that we need to make a lot more products, a lot more hardware out of this metal. As you're probably aware, 316 marine grade stainless steel is what they use on boats. So yeah, naturally we just massively increased our range, you know, to butt hinges, to pull handles, to scutcheons, to lever handles. We just, over time, brought out more and more of this product made from this metal. We were lucky to have a bit of an engineer working for us, you know, to get us set up properly. So our core had always been timber, and it remained that way for quite a long time. Then we started noticing that some of the composite door guys were noticing our blue branded product. So blue represents 316 Marine Grade Stainless Steel. And we actually noticed from the stats on some email campaigns, because when you send out an email, you'll get to see from...
This is your marketing site coming out now, isn't it?
5 days afterwards, whatever, that you can see trends of the type of people and the people that were opening it multiple times. And we're noticing that the composite door guys were opening our blue stainless steel range e-shots quite a bit. So we're missing a trick here. So we did some marketing to that market. And pretty much overnight we had a barrage of inquiries. And that's led to some of our biggest customers today in the composite door market being our most valuable and largest customers as a result of that email campaign, or those email campaigns. So that was interesting. So today, probably 40%, just under 40% of our revenue is from our blue brand, which is a product that we design in-house. So we've got two guys full-time in research and development, and we want to create that further. At the moment, we have roughly between 30 and 40 items on the boil, as in being designed, going through the various stages, testing, prototyping, etc. Yeah, we're still a family-owned business today. Okay, father and three sons. And
Three sons. I didn't realise it.
Yeah.
So you've all got your own roles that
My brother looks after procurement and finance. And then I've got another brother who looks after warehousing. And then we've got another brother that's joining sales team, hopefully next year sometime.
Right.
So we look forward to giving him a hard time.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's but it works as a family business. It's something that I originate from as well. So I sort of understand how it sort of usually works. And I think it's quite powerful. Mm. It's quite powerful.
Very passionate about quality. Strongly believe that quality always wins. Yeah, that saying, you know, you buy cheap, pay twice. Mm-hmm. How true that is.
100%.
And so many times we've been offered product from, you know, low cost China. We could buy product from China for a third of the price, probably less, but we know full well that the samples, the first shipment will be fine, but shipments thereafter is not up to standard. At the moment, less than 1% of our product comes from China, and our goal by the end of this year is to be completely out of China for ethical
1% is pretty good, but
reasons. We don't support what that country portrays. We think or feel that quality is not consistent or reliable. So we...
This just means you can, you know, it much better keep it here or you know, just out of China.
And to go one step further, to keep full control of quality, as you've seen yourself in the
day. Yes, yeah, I have, yeah.
We went into the manufacturing area where we bring in components from various suppliers around the globe, including quite a few manufacturers in the UK. And we're... you know, building our own product on site.
I have to say, it's one of the neatest workshops I've ever seen. So anyone listening to this, very nice. Nice what a setup you've got there. And plenty of space, I notice, as well.
Plenty of space to scale, build. Lots more opportunity. So yeah, that's the... we really want to push down the quality route. It's happened before where we've lost a customer on price, and, you know, within a couple of months later, they're back again with their tail between their legs, because quality always wins. There's no shortcut. And what fascinates us is someone selling let's take a £3,000 aluminium door, and they're putting a £15 handle on. It's just, it's ludicrous, really, because that's the only part of a door that the handle, that the customer touches. Why would you compromise on a handle? Imagine if Merck or Audi put a £10 handle on a 50 grand car. If the handle breaks, the end user generally brands that door as a pull door.
Yeah.
When it's not a pull door, they've just put the wrong bit of hardware on it.
Hey, you're right.
So yeah. To us, hardware is the fundamental part to get right and not to cut corners. So we allow no compromise of products. Another reason we have started doing in-house assembly more is often you'll go to a factory and, you know, wherever it is, Middle East, Far East, wherever, and they'll say they can make the perfect product through and through. But in reality, every factory around the globe has a sweet spot. So we religiously just stick to their sweet spot. So we're now at a stage where our spindles come from Italy. Our gaskets come from a local factory in Cornwall. Our springs come from British. Castings all over the place, some Middle East, some in Poland. We just use factories based on what their sweet spot is. And then we're trying to assemble more product on site here. So we're in full control of quality.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
We've had to learn a lot over the past 15 years, but yeah, onwards and upwards.
Yeah. So 15 years ago is when you started, this company started.
Yeah, 2004.
So 2004. So what, you say you joined after a year. What were you doing before this company?
When we first moved to Cornwall, we refurbished refurbished this old tyre factory into offices, essentially, put mezzanine floor in, etc. And then when he moved into that new premises, we then had his old corn store. Before that, I was working fitting suspended ceilings.
Right. Now, that's interesting, because probably the first person I've ever met that's done that.
Yeah.
Into offices. So this is...
Very different to what we've been doing. Yeah. We haven't been born and bred in the hardware world, if you like.
Yeah.
We actually had a friend when we lived in London that suggested we got into architectural ironmongery. Obviously, our business today is ironmongery, but in a very specialist form.
That makes sense. So you started... is that what you did when you left from school then, basically? You went straight into... or did you...
Yeah, so... 16 when I moved. So yeah, left year 12 and straight into the job down here of refurbishing this old tyre factory.
Right, I see.
And so I've not actually had another job, employed job. Although that's probably a bad thing. I do think starting, when leaving school, if you've got a family with a business, I think going to another business first before you come to your family business is a good thing to do.
I did that.
Bad habits from day one.
I'd say all it did is open my eyes to, I went to quite a large company and the people were great, but what I did realize is because it was so big, departments used to fight one another.
Yeah.
And then when I did join the family business, we didn't have any of that. It was like everyone's in this together. So it did help me open my eyes to say, wow, this is really different.
Yeah.
And you did have a name, mm-hmm. You're not just a number, and that kind of thing that went with it. So that's interesting. So you've got some skills then, because you got stuck in there and helped, converted that into an office.
Yeah.
So you're quite a hands-on kind of person.
Yeah, my dad's, he got all the city and guilds in carpentry and joinery. He spent most of his career in the Ritz Hotel.
Right.
So yeah, he used to travel to London every day. So yeah, I suppose I come from a very practical background, which helps. It helps massively here also when you're selling a product that you understand the application of it.
Yeah.
Because, many hardware companies today, all they know is the item and the part number, whereas we try and spend the time understanding the application and the process of fitting it and areas to improve. So... at Coastal today, we have 3 ex-customers, so 3 ex-joiners.
Right.
Purely because it massively helps us be relevant to our particularly joinery customers. So customers will phone up and get that typical hands-on, advice.
Hmm.
So we've got some big plans. By the end of this year, we'll be around 40 staff.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So, how many did you start with then? So, when you first opened?
So, yeah, Dad started it from scratch, 2004. I joined him 12 months later. Yeah, our first employee was a lady. Looking back, it's hilarious. She did we used Sage 950.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Back in the dark ages. Then we had two more employees. Then my brother joined us. Went from there.
What was your role straight away then when you first joined?
Well, it's everything. I remember, picking orders in the warehouse, entering orders. Yeah, a bit of outbound sales, a bit of inbound customer service.
So you didn't have a title as such. It was more just do whatever I got to do that day. Yeah.
A doer.
Yeah, a doer, not a don'ter.
Get stuff done.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great experience, great learning experience. And you never stop learning. We've still got a lot to learn, an awful lot to learn, especially with the pace of business change is pretty dramatic compared to 20, 30, 40 years ago, I'm sure. Especially in the marketing world.
Yeah, well, I was just about to say that. So where does your marketing background come from? Because it's something, you're just natural at it.
I don't know. We are quite marketing orientated.
I know you've got a team. Yeah. I'm not taking away anything from them. But which is also a good indicator that you value marketing. When a company has a team, that says a lot to me.
Yeah, sure. Like, as I said to you earlier, I believe there should be as many people in marketing as there is sales, and that we're working towards that. We've got 5 in marketing and roughly 8 in sales. So the ratio's coming closer.
Was that always the case from day one? Did you see marketing as important, or was it a case that no?
Definitely not.
Interesting.
No, it was very, sales orientated initially. But marketing is there to put awareness out there, and the salespeople are there to follow up the interest that comes as a result of that awareness. Pretty much on imagery. So collage shots, we call it benchmark angle shots. We got a few customers request particular angles to match in with their marketing, so we can be flexible and do that. But images is there's a lot to learn. And after 3 years of doing it, she's doing a very good job.
Yeah, well, you've just completely baffled me there, because that no one really does that, I don't think. You know, having people dedicated to this particular job is so important.
Yeah.
Because you get the best.
It comes back to focus, doesn't it? You've got to dedicate resource to get a job done, and not only get the job done, but get the job done well. So many people start a website.
100%.
Resource gets put elsewhere, and it comes to an end where... the ABC, always be completing. That's what we were taught. Finish it before you move on to the next thing. We're not perfect at that at all. Lots to learn still. Video is our next big push. So we spoke about, gathering the questions that your customers are asking and turn that into short, pithy, understandable
100%.
Content for your website. Video speaks 1,000 words, doesn't it?
Yes, 100%.
So we're recruiting for that role at the moment. This week we recruited our first apprentice, so we're going down that road, and she is rolling out the job of digital marketing. So her sole focus will be SEO work.
Very nice.
Dedicated to that. So yeah.
So are these things, is this because of you just saying, yes, we need to do this and you're on board? Is this something that you used to try and do years ago and it was harder to sell to maybe your dad?
Well, it's seeing is believing. You see others doing it. If you see others doing it and getting results from it, then why wouldn't you follow the same book? Especially video content marketing. We still do all the traditional email marketing campaigns bi-weekly.
There's always a place for traditional. I don't think it's the time to stop anything. I never sort of, I know we talk a lot about marketing on this podcast occasionally, and it's never something, I'm not here to say stop absolutely everything. Someone can always convince me. I was talking to someone the other week, and they were saying flyers, they still use flyers. And I said, what, how, why? And he basically said, look, my my nan has an iPad, but she doesn't, you know, she'll still buy anything that comes through the door in a flyer format. Yeah. And I thought, okay, so for the end, you know, I sort of look at B2B flyers, you know, some people are moving away from them, end up giving away iPads, I think, at some point. But there's a place for everything.
Yeah.
So I think it's important. It's a very hard thing to just go all in on something and say, you're not doing anything else. You've got to. But I think you're doing that. That sounds like your business model, because you've got different areas that you're working on as well, which is nice.
Yeah, we've got this big debate going on internally at the moment. Traditionally, we've always spent like between 15,000 and 35,000 on a big all-in-one catalogue. Yeah, 150-page catalogue, whatever.
Yeah.
We've done it every year for years and years. And we're getting a few questions like, well, if people want to find out about a product, isn't their first action website? Would they actually reach over to the shelf and grab a catalogue anymore? Some argue that the older generation, like the baby boomers, they still like paper.
Yes, yeah.
But in reality, I think if you went to see a customer in this day and age and you were referring to a product and you watched whether they moved their mouse to go to your website or reached behind them to get a catalogue, we're coming round to the belief, I suppose, that website is where the investment should go, and maybe printed marketing could just be used from a door opener point of view, you know, product launch or. But it's also interesting, why do Screwfix still do a catalogue?
I've often thought that, and I was just thinking about them. That's exactly what I thought of when you said about printing. And I think they might change. I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that they keep them in the van and they are old school. They probably haven't got Signal. They haven't got, you know, whereas I was just thinking, if there's a search bar on your website, that's what I go for every time. Any website, I'm always looking for the search bar.
Yeah.
It's very rare that I use, and I look at websites from a few different points of view, and no one ever uses a website how you design it. Yeah, they find their own way.
Yeah.
And you have to leave it open so that multiple people can find whatever they want, and you can push something in their face and they might see that, but they're not going to see you know, the handle that you've got on page 10 of the website. So the search bar is the most powerful thing, I think. And absolutely. I think that's what, especially on the phone, I don't think some people get too far and they say, oh, maybe we need an app. Apps are becoming something that it could just be another, you know, it's a nice thing to have, and if it's easy and it's easy to download, great, but it's just another sticking point for some people to think, I don't want to download an app, I just want to go on your website. Works on any device, it's done, you're in full control of it, you've got 2-3 people working on it already. I think you're doing the right thing with that.
And a printed catalogue gets out of date very quickly.
You can just keep it fresh, and as soon as something changes.
Absolutely. We've still got thousands sitting on our shelves here.
I'd also argue you can have multiple images, whereas the catalogues you can only usually get one, maybe two. Yeah, and it's just.
Yeah.
And they can use them as well. Do you make them available if customers want to use them on the website?
The catalogue?
The images that you've been taking.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
On our product pages, there's a image download button. If people want high-res images for printing them in their
literature,
then we just set up a shared OneDrive folder and share them in there. It works quite well.
Yeah, nice.
But yeah, there always will be a place, I think, for printed literature.
Yeah, maybe it's, like you say, support. But I think the best thing you've got is I saw those display boards, you know, and the boxes that you've got, the sample boxes, are like works of art, in my opinion. It's all neatly done. It looks the part. It is the part. Mm-hmm. And I think if you could put more money into that instead of a catalogue, I think hands down that your customers more sales more than anything.
Yeah.
It's not about convenience for you. You're looking to do the right thing, which is, I think that's what some people think. They think you're trying to cut the money, but that money will only go on the website. It's not like it's not going to be used.
Yeah.
I suppose there's environmental factors as well, you're not printing, it's just that there's a lot of good to come of it. So
absolutely,
I'd be leaning towards a website.
If you had 20 grand to spend and you're given the choice, printed literature or website, I'm of the 100% belief that money should be dedicated to website. It's a website has become your credibility, isn't it?
Yes.
If you are considering using a company, the first thing a majority of people would do was go online. And that first 3 seconds is so important, isn't it?
Yes.
Can I trust this website? Does it match what I'm looking for? is their brand going to add value to my business, etc.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, as I said before, you're really good with the branding. It's a nice feel. You get everything you've designed, the office, the handle, the product. It all works, and it's exactly what brand is.
Yeah. Display boards are going well for us, as we touched on.
Yes,
earlier.
Yeah.
We want to expand that. So we have three sizes of board that we offer a customer, and we use a local machine, CNC machine shop. So one of our guys in-house plots all of the hardware on the board, creates a DWG file, send it out to the road, they machine it, comes back, and we fit it up here in the assembly room and send it to the customer. We don't send loose samples with the board, because it's always typical that the board ends up in the corner getting dusty with a loose sample. So we make sure we fit it up here, send it straight to the customer so they can put it straight on the wall. We're seeing some good impact from that.
There's not much else you could do there except turning up to fit it as well. Yeah. That's the last step.
And the door handle is so, as I said earlier, the door handle is so important on a door. I was reading a few nights ago, the Range Rover Velar, okay, that has come out 2 years, 3 years ago. In the top three reasons that people purchase the Range Rover Velar is the door handle. So that shows the power.
Yeah.
That, end users fasten on a particular detail. And if they want that, they'll have that.
Yeah.
They'll pay come what may. So attention to detail is a way that door window companies can massively add value, make more margin for themselves, and make their, a high quality window handle can make a window, just from a perception point of view, go from £400 to £600 just by spending an extra £10 on a handle.
Now, and as we said before, I like that they match. And I see what you're doing with door handles, even with the monkey tails. And I completely get it.
Yeah.
I could always see it. And I always saw it as the customers, they were looking for that kind of thing. A lot of our customers that I used to deal with were looking. And as I said to you, they would attach to something like a handle because, like you say, it's the thing that they touch. It's the most important thing. I always marketed it as that you're not set in stone. Two screws and we can change this. And there were some customers that they changed their bathroom and they just, as long as you could let them know that two screws and they could swap, that's great. You'd almost, there's a market there. I think there's an after sales market somewhere because just offering that service to swap two handles, take two screws out and change the handles for the whole house.
Yeah.
People would do that because, like you say, it's such an important part of the way it can change a window for some people, especially the colors. And your range of colors is amazing. So
I think the satin brass, which is a PVD satin brass over stainless steel, that's really starting to move now. Looks excellent on dark. And we've heard of many times customers have actually won an order off the basis of offering a quality hardware upgrade. You can't get more credible than that.
No.
A lot of door and window companies are really missing a trick by not offering a high quality upgrade. It's always the case, isn't it? A couple comes into your showroom and the wife generally calls the shots.
Yeah.
And it's the wives that always fast on that detail.
Yeah.
And the detail on a door and window generally is hardware, amongst other things, of course. But
I remember those.
Keen to help customers make more margin by encouraging them to offer a quality upgrade.
It was always, I remember those because you'd see the couples come in and you just see the partner looking at you sort of saying, how much is this going to cost me? You've got expensive taste there. But it's what they wanted.
Yeah.
The funniest one I always found was the couples that came in and that one of them would say, I've got no opinion, I don't care, whatever. And then the other one would pick something and they go, not that one. So I think they just said he didn't care, but obviously you do.
Yeah.
So they try and be relaxed about it, but it's funny. It's and a lot of it was colour.
Yeah.
A lot of it was the finish.
Yeah.
Because that was the most important thing. That if it was over design or finish, I think finish would win. And then design came in. And if they could get the best of both, they'd take those handles with them when they moved. They loved them that much.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. And the end user is so much more discerning these days.
Yeah.
The internet's at their fingertips. And like you say, finish is so true, that starts the direction of choosing.
Anything,
you know, from flooring to walls to hardware to doors, you know.
One thing I have always, you're probably the man to ask about this, have you ever considered, it's something that I always thought of and I wondered if I'd ever be able to sell them, gold-plated or putting gold plate into windows and door handles? Is it something, has anyone ever done it?
I'm not aware of anyone. I'm sure it's been done.
I can imagine. I'm sure I heard about it maybe on sort of like one of these hotels in Dubai or something like that. And I thought, I wonder if that would work here. You know, there'd be someone would just say, look, whatever happens, I'll sell the window handles. And you think, what?
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe an 18 karat gold, maybe a 9 karat gold just to start things off.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to potentially play around with solid bronze next, but solid bronze is.
So that's the future, yeah.
Very hard material to work with. I mean, 3-on-16 still is hard enough to work with. That's using a investment casting. So those door handles I was showing you earlier, those solid stainless steel door handles, that started off as a piece of wax. So every piece of solid stainless steel starts off as a piece of wax. So basically they create a wax mold and then they cover it in like a sand ceramic. Has about 6 layers of this sand ceramic coated. That then forms a shell, if you like. Then they heat those up and pour the wax out. And then once that's dried, they'll then pour molten 3-on-16 steel into that mold.
Right, yeah.
And then 2 days later, they'll smash the sand ceramic shell off. And that gives you your lump of stainless steel. Then it goes through a polishing process. But yeah, it's a very interesting process, the investment casting of stainless steel.
I do want to see that one day.
Very specialist.
I need to see that. I love anything like that. So hence why I started making some videos behind the scenes. So
sure.
There's 2 questions I just want to ask you. In the whole time that you've been working here, in your fenestration journey, should we say, what's the lowest point and highest point? Is there a low point that you sort of thought, ooh?
You mean running the business? Or
probably, or anything that sort of sticks out for you. So maybe running the business or just at any point during your time here.
Yeah, sure. I haven't exactly got anything in the fenestration point of view. As far as building a business, I remember trying to implement the concept of lean in 2016. So we efficiently build a business. And so we had some consultants come in for roughly 18 months to try and help us implement lean. And that was a very difficult year, getting staff to believe in lean culture.
Imagine.
Yeah. You know, like the daily huddles and the visual scoring, the way you think even, removing waste that the customer does not find any value in. Bringing that, I 150% believed in lean, but trying to get the rest of the staff to believe in it so we can scale efficiently. But systemize your business. That was a really tough time. And then straight afterwards, we implemented a new ERP system in 2017. We went live with NetSuite, Oracle NetSuite, and I probably spent 70% of the year implementing that or helping the business to implement it. But they're the 2 challenges that come to mind. So yeah, first scaling or setting up to scale the business through lean culture and implementing a new ERP system. That's painful.
Really painful. You had to do it though, because 100%. You wouldn't be here where you are today without doing that.
100%, yeah.
Otherwise you just, I think, and that, I think, companies that they do make that mistake, they just sort of keep going and just see what happens, and then at some point they've got to bring the consultants in. Or they don't, and they don't really stick around too long after that.
You're either growing or you're going backwards, aren't you?
That's starting to make sense now. I can sort of see everything that's here and how it's working, and it's you're not afraid to invest in.
Absolutely. And now it's about building the team. So for my role personally, I'm trying to extract myself, kind of not so much working in the business, but on the business, which is a challenge because delegation is a very hard thing to accept and learn. But we're working on that, getting there.
So when did you become managing director then? When did that?
I suppose pretty much from, unfortunately, from day dot, really.
And then was it, do you ever remember a time where it sort of, or was it just all being the same? So was there a certain point when you go, and then your duties changed so much? Or was it more as staff or the team grew, it sort of,
no,
you changed?
No, it's, I've not, it's not felt like my role's changed from day dot.
That's interesting, yeah.
It's been, I suppose, building a business, leading people. And now we've got to the stage where we have, you know, department managers. And it's so true what's said that, you know, running a bigger business is a lot easier than running a small business. Because you've got a small business, you go on holiday, everything goes to pot, doesn't it? You have a bigger business with every department managed by a person, with people under them. You can go on holiday for a week or two and not worry about it.
Yeah.
Whereas you couldn't have done that when you were three-man band.
Literally the definition of more a job or career and having a business that runs without you.
Yeah.
So that's really what your main focus is, really, just to keep
building the business, but at the same time, remaining very customer-centric. Not one of our products has come from our own idea. Every single product we've created has come from a customer saying, hey, how about this? Or you've got this, can you do this to it?
So
just keep it customer centric. Customers pay our wages. We don't pay our own wages.
That's really interesting because that's, you're solving problems. If they've got a problem, you solve it. You've got a business. And that's what everyone, I listen to a lot of stuff like that. And that's very interesting that you're doing it that way.
Yeah.
Because you could come up with, and a lot of business do, you go, this is great, look at this handle, we've made all this, and people say, well, we don't want it.
Exactly.
And then you end up changing anyway, so that's very smart if you're listening to them straight away.
And generally speaking, if one customer has suggested it, it's very likely that many other customers will be thinking the same thing. So, you know, listen to your customers. You've got two ears and one mouth for a very good reason.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. Well, last question then. Is there a high point in all of this? Is there sort of, or is it still going?
It's still going. We're still a very small fish compared to what we want to be. We still want to scale. We still want to, we've got a lot of work to build the brand still. We're getting a lot more inquiries from Europe, some of the factories in Poland, Latvia, Lithuania. So we want to expand into those countries. We also ship every month, I'd say, a product to America.
I was going to say America. So everyone seems to be, America's like the new site for a lot of people out there. So
yeah. But yeah, keep going, keep growing, try and become more and more relevant to our customers. But our real passion is adding value to our customers' products. That's why we turn up at work every day, is our customers make a great product and we want to make it, you know, from good to great by helping them understand and see that they can add so much value to their product, and in turn they can make more margin. We've got so many customers that offer so much hardware that it causes them a nightmare. The end user will go off and find a product that doesn't fit for whatever reason. We're really trying to help our customers systemize their range. So, you know, here's three ranges, here's the finishes, just offer that and stick with that and you'll also become lean. Because they're not wasting time giving too much choice. You take Tesla, amazing example. Four models, four colours, two interior colours, that's it. That's how you can scale.
You're right, actually. I never thought of it that way.
And generally speaking as well, for years now, we've seen our most profitable customers are the ones that systemize. So they spend time on process. They spend time on, you know, deciding a range. Like we'll create a window and the window is called XYZ. Here's the colors you can have. Here's the glass you can have. Here's the handles you can have. They're the ones making the money. The ones that are always reinventing the wheel are the ones that don't seem to get ahead in life because they offer, They wait for their customer to throw ideas at them rather than the window and door fabricator saying, look, here's our scope. What would you like?
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I know what you mean. That it's trying to find, I suppose there is a balance. I was always, as a salesperson, I always felt like I was trying to solve people's problems. So I always took things back to our factory. It's like, can we do this? I'm pretty sure we can do this. I can't see why we're not. You know, and it's, but should we do this? And that was always me because I was facing the customer. I was trying to solve a problem that we didn't necessarily need to solve. And we could have simplified a lot of it.
Yeah. And if that was a request and it's a valid request, then that should be implemented as part of your process.
Well, and that's part of it. And a lot of the times, if we did do something like that, it did become an option that we could then, and that's what they sort of looked at it. If it didn't look like it was going to be a likely thing that they could offer to other people, we didn't really do it. But, you know, also you create custom handles as well, so bespoke, and you can do that kind of thing. So you sort of, that allows you the option to help customers still when they need it. But then, as you say, it's sort of your R&D as well, because you can say, well, we can do it, and then we can now offer this to everyone. But I think initially it's very overwhelming. One of the reasons why I started making videos and things like this is a lot of consumers don't know where to turn. There's so many options out there. They don't know what to start with. And branding is very important. And this is a conversation we're having with a lot of people. And America's very good at branding. We're, you know, a lot of our companies in this country are really trying to catch up. We just, and I think you were right. So it may be an old school thing. It was just something that people didn't have to worry about. I think that the world was a little bit smaller and everyone used to talk and say, yeah, if you need such and such, go to them. And now everyone's shouting, look at me, look at us, we've got this, we're the best. And everyone's thinking, okay, now I need to go back to recommendations. And it will come down to branding, 100%. I always follow Apple. I think the biggest thing that a lot of people don't understand about even your products is if they think it's just the Chinese products, for example, with a higher price, that's what they think, you know, and they don't see the value in that. But if they just take the time to understand it, and as you said, a lot of companies now are seeing the difference. They may leave on price and then come back next month. That is very powerful and important because they're starting to see the value. And I think there's just a mindset. I did it with Apple once. I feel bad now because I thought they just really overcharged for the iPhone. Still buy one. It didn't stop me because I like what they do and I like how they do it. But I was listening to something the other day and I realized the guy was explaining they you're basically paying up front for it because the likes of Google, when they make a phone, they make the money on the back end because they're selling your data. Apple doesn't do any of that. They pay their technicians more. They pay all their suppliers better pricing. So there is a cost. They're better at branding, and branding is a cost, and marketing, and it all goes into that. So, but you like the idea that those companies will still be around. And this is the thing. You can have some companies that will charge you very, very cheap prices, but they might not be there next year. And that's going to let you down and cost you more in the long run anyway. So it's, yeah, I think, yeah, well, I'm interested to see what happens in the next few years then. We'll keep an eye. I'm sure we'll be back on the podcast at some point.
Look forward to it, yeah.
But
yeah, hopefully our manufacturing arm is a lot more advanced than what it is today.
Yeah.
That is what is exciting, going back to your earlier question, is we are becoming a creator, designer and manufacturer of hardware rather than just a reseller of hardware. So we're in control of our own designs, and we have many customers today where we, you know, own brand or make special configurations for various reasons.
It's a nice thing. It just means that you're in full control, and it's, yeah, I know it's a nice feeling to have, because you do, especially with everything that's happened in the last year or so with supply issues, you do feel a little bit sort of vulnerable at times. So the more you can do in-house, I think, and it's a good thing for our economy anyway, sort of in the UK.
Absolutely, yeah. We want to support, yeah, British as much as we can.
Yeah, and with the apprenticeships as well that you're bringing in as well, you're doing everything right for the industry as well. So, well done. Keep up the good work.
Great stuff.
Thank you very much for your time. And as I said, you may come back on at some point, see how you're getting on in a couple of years' time, or if something happens sooner. But thank you very much.
No problem, Richard.
Take care.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
That was a great conversation with Lauren. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you would like to hear more conversations like this one, consider subscribing. Otherwise, thank you for listening. Until next time.